Blog Talk Radio.
Readers Entertainment Radio, where variety is the spice of life.
Well, a little short on the music. Sorry about that. I know how much everybody loves my theme music, but hello, and welcome to Readers Entertainment Radio. I'm your host, Sheila English, and tonight we're going to talk about skullduggery and disturbing the dead. And this topic was so intriguing to me, especially since I have a morbid sense of curiosity. I was thrilled to get Brian Kennard to come on the show and chat with us, and he and I were just talking before we went live, and I was telling him, you know, I get a lot of people who will email and say, you know, here's my topic, if there's a place for me on your show. And as soon as I started reading the email I got from Brian, it's like, oh, I've got to get this gentleman on my show. This is something that you don't hear a whole lot about. And of course, you know, you talk about things like grave robbery and stuff like that, and you're just immediately, you know, who goes around and thinks about that? But there's a lot of stories there. Now, for our listeners, you can join us. We have the live chat that's already up, and you can join us by logging in at blogtalkradio.com/circle-of-7. And you can call in and chat with us at 646-200-4071. An hour after the show, you can download the podcast or even embed it into your own site or social profile, or catch the highlights, behind the scenes, and the podcast at our new website, readersentertainment.tv/radio. Now, Brian, I want to thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
I want to give our listeners your website right away. That way, when we're talking, if they would like to go and check it out, and maybe that will inspire some questions.
Sure.
Then let me go ahead and give them that. It is www.skullduggerythebook.com. That's skullduggerythebook.com. And, of course, this is very timely, as this weekend, I believe, is Elvis Presley's birthday weekend. And I think maybe today is even his actual birthday.
Yes.
Yeah.
I believe so.
Yeah, and I know we're going to talk a little bit about Elvis tonight, which is kind of exciting. But to get started, Brian, tell us about your new book, Skullduggery, 45, that really got me, by the way, 45 True Tales of Disturbing the Dead.
Well, my book's a compilation of stories about real-life grave robberies and other disturbances of the dead. You've got all sorts of purposes behind these grave robberies: extortion, avarice, greed, religious and occult purposes, and sometimes they're even done out of pure affection or love. I mean, these stories range from people that are famous to, you know, common people like you or me. I mean, I've got stories in there about Elvis, Charlie Chaplin, the Skull and Bone Society, Thomas Paine, Alexander the Great. I mean, all these people have had their bodies either robbed after their own demise, or they've had plots to have their bodies carried off, as in the case of Elvis. But it kind of represents a folklore and a hidden history that we have. I mean, people's histories don't necessarily just end with when they die, and these stories are things that, you're right, no one really likes to talk about. And in researching the book, I found out even, you know, state and local legislatures don't like to talk about these things, because a lot of these acts would end up being not criminalized once the perpetrators were found. You know, they catch somebody with someone's body or having raided someone's grave, and the police, the attorneys would look around and there'd be no laws on the books to prosecute these folks. And a lot of these cases actually help progress legal history to make sure that these things were punished criminally. But I've got actually 34 tales that I wrote in there, and then 11 tales from the 1880s that came from the New York Times that represent actual newspaper reports of grave robbing back during that time period. And not only are the situations fascinating in and of themselves, but the language back then and the treatment of some of the situations is pretty interesting as well.
Now, I think that's very interesting that you have the stories that you, I mean, obviously you've done a lot of research. Now, how did you become interested in writing?
Well, I started writing about 4 years ago. I'm a 32nd degree Scottish Rite Mason and have always had a lifelong love of Holy Grail lore. And I started doing a blog and some research into topics about the Holy Grail and the Knights Templar and Freemasonry, and started a blog called Grail Seekers, and caught the writing bug that way. And actually, I got the idea for doing this book. I was doing an interview with Patrice Chaplin, who is Charlie Chaplin's daughter-in-law. She had written a book about some of her experiences when she was a young girl in Spain. The book is called City of Secrets. And in doing some back research on her, I found out that in 1977, Charlie Chaplin's body was stolen for purposes of extortion. And this just fascinated me. I thought, this can't be something that happens commonly. And I started doing some more research into it, and I found that this happens more often than one would think. It's not necessarily common, of course, but to give an example of how timely it is, back at the beginning of December of last year, the ex-president of Cyprus's body was stolen a year to the day after he was buried for ostensibly political purposes in a political protest about some policies that were going on. So it happens all the time.
Huh. Now, how did you go about getting your book published?
Well, actually, I did that all myself. It was kind of an education. I went through CreateSpace on Amazon and designed the cover and did all the layout myself and taught myself how to do all that. And I think I came out with a pretty good product. So here I am being my own marketing department talking to you this evening.
Yeah. Well, I did go to your website and I did see some of that. I mean, you have everything. You have just about every format that I could think of available.
I tried to do as many electronic formats. I've got it available, of course, in traditional print through Amazon, also Kindle format and EPUB format, PDFs. If it's electronic and you want to get a copy of it and save the planet by going green and getting an e-copy of it, I've got it out there for you.
All right. Now, the subject matter of skullduggery is a little morbid. Why choose to write about grave robbers?
Well, the topic is actually, like I said earlier, it's a hidden history of people's lives. Nobody likes to talk about death. No one relishes the thought of what might happen to them after they die. In these stories, you might see them show up in a newspaper. There might be a small mention about them, but they're never covered very extensively because the topic resonates with a fear that we all have and of actually having our bodies disturbed. I mean, this goes back, and I talk about this a little bit in my introduction, even into my family history a little bit. My grandmother was a good country woman from about 45 minutes west of Nashville in a little place called Ashland City. And she used to tell a tale of back during the Depression, one of our long-lost family members, and when she used to tell this, I was young enough not to make the familial connections with it, but of an ancestor that was buried with a wedding ring on, and evidently there was some family dispute as to who should have the wedding ring and the scandal that the person being buried with the ring actually brought. And she'd always end the story with, well, so-and-so went out and dug them up in the middle of the night and they took that wedding ring. That's not going to happen to me. And even back then, I thought, you've got to be kidding me.
Yeah.
There, Exactly, and she only told the story a couple times, so I don't believe it was one of those, you know, boogeyman type stories. But like I said, it's something that continues the life story or the story of someone's existence that swept under the carpet a little bit, that has become folklore and that boogeyman aspect of it. So I thought it was important to tell some of these stories. And you get into all sorts of motives with this. You know, for science, Einstein's brain was stolen from his autopsy for science reasons, political reasons. I didn't include the story of the ex-president of Cyprus. That kind of gives you an idea as to the fervor that people have about the politics and to what lengths they might go for either protests or use someone that, like Eva Perón or Che Guevara, to prop up their own political motives using their dead bodies. I mean, these remains become an icon and, you know, in some cases, of course, have religious significance too. I mean, within the Catholic faith, the relics of saints have power, you know, to possibly perform miracles. So the entire topic is ingrained within our culture, whether we realize it or not. I mean, the entire story of Frankenstein is essentially about, the first half of the book is essentially about grave robbery.
Right.
So once again, it's something that's in the tip of our minds, but no one wants to explore it.
Right.
So,
now, did you find that, you know, when you're doing your research, did you find there was a lot of superstition concerning grave robbing?
Not as much as you'd think. My 8-year-old son, while I was writing this, kept asking me, are there any grave robbing ghost stories, Dad? And I never really found any. There is a section that I put in the book that follows some grave robberies that ostensibly had occult connections. And when I say occult, I mean occult in the true sense of the word by hidden meaning. Skull and Bone Society is a great example. Supposedly, they possess the skulls of Che Guevara, Martin Van Buren, Pancho Villa, and Geronimo in the tomb at Yale. And I have a chapter in there that discusses and the possibilities of them actually having that. But if they possessed those skulls, they would be for a ritual purpose, and therefore occult or hidden to the rest of us.
Right.
So not as much superstition about that, but as part of my research, my wife and I actually went out to a graveyard at the stroke of midnight on Halloween just to see what it was like, you know, and what the feeling was. And I tell you what, anybody that would go out and do that, it has to have some mental fortitude to them. I mean, it's creepy. There's no doubt. I mean, sounds are magnified. The wind's blowing. Every horror movie cliche that you can think of happens at a graveyard at night, and your imagination goes wild. So you can only imagine the people that perpetrated these crimes, what they would have had to have done, not only to overcome that obstacle, but to actually do the physical work to steal, dig up a grave and steal the bodies.
You know, the first story that came to mind, and I don't know if this is a perfect fit, but I think it's close, is the mummy, the story of the mummy. You know, they dig him up and disturb his tomb, and they're cursed, you know.
Well, I mean, think about this, too. What about archaeologists? I mean, within our culture, we give archaeologists a pass to be grave robbers. Because just because a body is 2,000 years old or 3,000 years old, does that make it any more ethical than the person in my family tree that dug up the body for a gold ring? I mean, we say that it's okay because it's in the name of science, but how would you feel if in 1,000 years some scientists dug up your remains because they wanted to see what made 21st century people tick?
Oh, I love that. I never really thought about that, but that's so true. That's so true. Archaeologists absolutely are digging up the dead and looking in tombs, and everybody seems to be okay with that. So that's very interesting. Now tell me, how long did it take you to complete this book?
About 4 months. I'd started it while I was in a career with a large corporate entity here in Nashville, and decided that I was not real happy with what I was doing. So I actually gave up my corporate career of 11 years and decided I'd follow my bliss and do what made me happy, and that's write and research and do things like this. So I did, and after that, it took me about two and a half months to finish it off. There was a ton of research.
Now, what is your favorite story from Skullduggery? Oh, and it looks like we may have lost our caller, just so everyone knows. Brian's in Nashville. I'm in Mount Sterling, Kentucky, and we are currently experiencing a big snowstorm. So I'm sure that Brian is going to call back, but I wanted to make sure that everybody knows, again, where to go to find out more about the book. I went to look up his website, and it's very easy just to kind of, you go there and you see all this very unique information, and it was really easy to kind of get lost there. So it's Skullduggery, the book. Oh, and looks like, yes,
I'm back, yes.
All right, he's back. Fantastic.
Not sure what technical glitch just happened, but.
Well, I was blaming it on the I'm in Kentucky. So,
oh, okay. Well, I'm in Nashville, so, we're neighbors.
Well, it could be. Let's blame it on the snow.
There you go.
Everything on the snow these days. So let me get back to you were saying that that you had left your corporate position follow your dream. So
you know, I took about 2 months after that to work on the book full time as far as the actual writing was concerned. And the amount of research I did for this, you would not think that it would take that much research, but I've got, you know, a few hundred sources listed, over 300 endnotes listed in the book, and I wanted to make sure that I got everything as accurate as I could. But even then, it was interesting because some of the stories that I ended up researching, you would find discrepancies even in news accounts of the same event. You know, they'd be minor and wouldn't change the overall story, but when you're doing research like that, you get to be fairly, or get intimate details, and little things stick out. So I had to try to discern what, you know, actually happened in some cases. And in some cases, the readers might actually see that they've heard a story that was told one way, or they thought that an event happened one way when possibly it did, and the news sources I had were either glossing over something or were, you know, once again had that mental block into folklore.
Right.
And the perfect example, we talked about Elvis earlier, it is the story of Elvis. When Elvis died in 1977, there were plans by Vernon Presley, his father. He wanted to bury Elvis at Graceland. Well, Memphis zoning laws precluded anyone being buried on private property or property that was not zoned as cemetery property. So he was buried in a vault at Forest Hills Cemetery there in Memphis, right off Elvis Presley Boulevard. About 2 weeks after Elvis was buried, a reporter by the name of Russell Ruffin, who I interviewed for the book, got a call by a man that he'd met before in a courtroom who actually told him, "Russell, I've been hired to steal the body of Elvis Presley, and I wanted to let you know, and we're going to do it this weekend." Ruffin thought this was just amazing that, one, this gentleman would call him and tell him that, but he was also had kind of a moral dilemma he's a reporter, and he was a reporter for a local Memphis TV station. And he wasn't quite sure whether he should keep the story to himself or tell the Memphis police, because, you know, I mean, this is a pretty big scoop. Well, Ruffin had a longstanding relationship with the Memphis police and knew that Forest Hills was patrolled by security guards and didn't want anybody to get hurt and inform the Memphis police, who actually performed a stakeout all weekend long on the crypt there at Forest Hills. And finally, on Sunday night, at the end of August in 1977, a car drives up and four men get out of the car and they start rattling the gate there in the mausoleum where Elvis was buried. They didn't have any burglary tools with them. And when the police descended upon them, they all scattered. One of them scaled a nearby interstate fence and had gotten away and was eventually arrested and then released. And the other three jumped back in their car and were, ironically enough, arrested on near Elvis Presley Boulevard there in Memphis. And when a search was done of their car, the official news reports in the Memphis Commercial Appeal had mentioned that there might have been a shotgun and explosives in their vehicle. Well, in speaking with Russell Ruffin, who was there that evening, he said, "I saw them search the vehicle. There might have been a shotgun there, but there were no burglary tools. They might have had a crowbar with them, but there were no explosives. There was no implements that would make one think that their intent would have been to rob a grave." Well, these three men go to trial in Memphis, and they're relying on the testimony of Ronnie Lee Atkins, who was the person that had contacted Ruffin to begin with. And he had told the court that they had been hired by a mysterious figure named Nucci to steal Elvis's body, and he was going to ransom it back to the Presley family. Well, the district attorneys in Memphis decided that he was crazy and he wasn't a credible witness and dismissed the case. It was actually a criminal trespassing case against all three, which, once again, reading the accounts, why would the district attorneys do that? They had a news reporter, a gaggle of Memphis police, the Forest Hills security force, that were all there that saw these guys entering this graveyard illegally. They were all very credible witnesses and could have easily prosecuted them, but they were let off. Well, you flash forward 20 years, and Ronnie Lee Atkins, who had since become an informant for the FBI, in an interview with WorldNet Daily, said that the person that really paid them off to steal Elvis's body was none other than Vernon Presley, Elvis's father. What his plan was, he didn't want them to actually steal Elvis's body, but just to make an attempt on it. And history kind of bears this out, because after the attempt in 77, the Presley family lawyers go to the city council of Memphis and say, "Guys, this is going to happen again. You know, either you go to the expense of protecting Elvis's body, you know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, or we will be more than happy to reinter him at Graceland," which, of course, the Memphis Council, seeing the financial wisdom of that, gave special dispensation to Graceland, and that's where Elvis rests now. Well, if you think about it, no one can make any money off going to Elvis Presley's tomb at a public cemetery, but you sure can at $15 or $20 a pop at Graceland. Uh-huh. So therein lies the skullduggery of Elvis Presley. And once again, these stories are not just about two guys with a pickaxe and a shovel going out and digging up a body and opening up the coffin and there being, you know, decomposition and all sorts of gross stuff going on. There's intrigue, there's politics, there's everything under the sun that you can imagine that are attached to one or more of these stories.
Now, I believe there was a Discovery Channel special on recently about stealing Abraham Lincoln's body. How accurate was that documentary?
That was very accurate as to the history of the plot to steal Lincoln's tomb. And unfortunately, with about 5 or 6 minutes left, I don't think I have time to go into all of it. But there was a plot by a Chicago counterfeiter to steal Lincoln's body to make a little cash to ransom it back to the government, and also to get his chief engraver out of jail. And the story turns into almost a Keystone Cop episode with the Secret Service getting involved. And at the time, there was even some debate as to whether the Secret Service should get involved in that. This is one of those cases where grave robbery in Springfield and in Illinois was not a criminal offense. So there was some conjecture as to what the authorities should do. Another little tidbit is that embedded within this Chicago crime boss's team that was to go out and steal Lincoln's body was a Secret Service informant. So the police knew exactly what was going on, exactly when they were going to strike. But the story goes on a little bit to where the Secret Service, along with some Pinkerton detectives, end up saving the day and eventually nabbing the grave robbers. But that doesn't end Lincoln's story as far as moving around his body over the years and some of the things that were done to protect his remains from further harm. But yeah, the Discovery Channel episode on that was fantastic and gives a good flavor as to how those type of things happen, and especially in the story of Lincoln.
Well, then I have to ask, you know, how do cemeteries try to make sure that the things you write about in Skullduggery, how do they make sure that those things don't happen?
Well, the long and short answer is cemeteries do rely on security to a certain extent. But most cemeteries simply rely on the fear of being in a cemetery at night and all, once again, the superstitions that go along with that is their chief protection. Now, if you're somebody with money, Michael Jackson case is just a great example. He spent over $1 million to make sure that his body was, or his family spent the money. He was interred at the Forest Lawn Cemetery in Glendale. There they have a compound that looks like a castle from the Dirty Dozen movies, a vault that has 24-hour security, you know, closed-circuit TV, the whole shooting match. You get arrested for trespassing if you're not supposed to be there. And that's the if you have the funds to pay for that type of security. But to be honest, most cemeteries out there don't have those resources. So it's fairly easy in many of the cemeteries to go in and do these type of things even today.
Now tell me, what's your next project?
Right now, I am writing a book that is an expansion of one of the stories in Skullduggery. There was too many connections and too much political intrigue for me not to. And hopefully I'll be submitting that in a Amazon self-publishing contest here in just a couple weeks.
All right. Well, I really want to thank you for joining us. This has been very intriguing, very exciting. I saw that we had a lot of people coming to visit on the live chat session, and hopefully they can come and check out your website at skullduggerythebook.com. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a blast.
And we want to thank our listeners for joining us here at Readers Entertainment Radio. This show will be downloadable within an hour for those wanting to download it. You can download it here on Blog Talk Radio /circle-of-7 or on iTunes, Audio, Blueberry, or whatever platform you may be listening on. Or, of course, you can go to the new website at readersentertainment.tv/radio. Please join us next week, Friday at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll be talking to Anita Higman about Christian fiction. And be aware of our new time and date starting January 28th will be on Thursdays from 6 p.m. Eastern Standard to 6:30 p.m. Again, I am your host, Sheila English, and we thank you very much for joining us. Happy reading.
This show brought to you by Circle of Seven Productions, www.cosproductions.com. Please be sure to subscribe and welcome to our circle.